back, fighters and philosophers alike, for everyone looking for the hard truth, letting the answers lead the way, not being deterred due to political correctness and all the other tools they use to shut down investigations. You've come to the right place. This is Red Eyes Radio. Now, does that mean that every program we do is the truth and nothing but the truth? No, it doesn't. We hear from a lot of different folks on this program. Some we agree with more, others less, but we want to arrive at the truth and we want to present it as accurately as we possibly can. And achieving that, we found it to be a good method by talking about many of the problems that we highlight from many different angles. That's why we hear a lot of people out, and we have over the years. We are always moving forward, learning more, excluding the untruths as we go, finding the contradictions that exclude them as possibilities, but also finding enough smoke in certain areas to determine that here there is fire. Sometimes it's also good to hear that which goes against everything you thought you knew. Well, actually, it's better to hear that more than sometimes. You know, put things in perspective. That is definitely true for the alternative viewpoint as well, especially among people who think they have all the answers already. You know, this is about arming ourselves with knowledge so that we can make the right choices. But also about talking with those people who are actually out on the street, not just staring at the screen and experiencing things out there and how things really are, and if things are indeed getting better or are they getting worse. We want to learn what really is going on and the tricks of the globalists, the methods they use, the people they use, and how they are doing it all. Well, today we have another gentleman with us to talk about just the techniques of the propagandists, the tool that propaganda is. Dr. Brian Enspatrick is a professor of communication at the University of Toledo. He joined the department in 2000 and holds a PhD in communication research from the University of Michigan. He teaches undergraduate and graduate courses in research methods, group communication, propaganda, and persuasion. His honors seminar on propaganda and social science and American gun policy have ranked as the most popular courses in the university's honor program. He is also a nationally recognized expert on American gun culture, frequently speaking at events and symposiums. His publications include 5 books and a number of scholarly articles, and today our focus is his book called The 10 Commandments of Propaganda. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. Thank you so much for coming on today. I hope you're doing well in Michigan.
Doing very well, Heinrich. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Well, thank you. It's great to have you here. I did receive a book, The 10 Commandments of Propaganda, from Arctos here a while ago. Very, very interesting book. I'm looking forward to talking more about it. This is, of course, a very important topic, as always, but I'd say particularly in these times, as kind of the noose is tightening, to, so to speak. But tell us when you became interested in propaganda, Brian.
I became interested in propaganda. I grew up in Detroit, which is a former city. I mean, it's still there, the shell. But essentially, Detroit, again, it's a shell of a city. It's a wrecked city. And as I grew up, I was exposed to a lot of propaganda. I was lied to a lot. And I think I became sensitive to it. I went to a parochial school for a few years, but they used to tell me fantastic stories. And then I went to public educational schools that were more like detention centers, which where I heard this rhetoric of truth and beauty that never ended, and yet there was no reality to accompany it. So I became very interested in that. I became very interested in crowd mobilization, how authority leads by misleading, and propaganda, in a sense.
How did you end up writing the book that you did on this?
Oh, a long journey. I pursued this virtual adolescent interest. I kid you not, when I was an adolescent, I was reading things like Gustave Le Bon. He wrote things on crowd psychology and so on. And I read these kind of books, and they always interested me. I read things by, like, Wilhelm Reich and stuff on the mass psychology of fascism. And I pursued this interest, and I had been invited to leave high school in Detroit at some early point. And I continued this on my own for many years. And I realized when I was well up into my 20s, that I could not educate myself in a vacuum. I had to have some sort of discussion, so I went off and sought formal education. And even during that, I eventually obtained a BA in English. I realized that, you know, you have to have your own interests, you have to have your own passions, and so on. And I was able to turn this into a master's degree eventually, and then eventually a doctorate and PhD. I eventually wound up going to the University of Michigan. I finished a dissertation on National Rifle Association mobilization. I pursued these interests. And I found often I had to swim upstream to pursue these interests as well. They weren't the interests of mainstream academia, because the mainstream academia was more interested in creating propaganda, sort of like administrative service, than it was in studying it. But it's buoyed me up for many years, and it's a fascination. It's a passion.
Before we go into the commandments as you list them and some of the various examples, there's some great stuff in the book I want to talk more about here. But maybe it would be pertinent to talk a little bit more about what propaganda actually is, what the term means. I mean, obviously, it's gone through a lot of kind of an evolution, if you will, over many, many years. But how would you define it for somebody who might be confused about what it is?
Propaganda is an old word. It's comes on the scene ecclesiastical sources. 1600, 1622 or so, there's a college or council of propaganda that forms in the Roman Catholic Church. And this is part of the Counter-Reformation. The purpose of this was to propagate the faith, or propagandize, propagate. And essentially, the Roman Catholic Church starts the first world-scope communication campaign. And this goes on. And they also, by the way, develop bureaucracy that goes with it. You know, essentially, bureaucracies speak. They communicate with propaganda. Let's put it that way. So hence the origin. And the College of Propaganda was very, very successful. It was essentially the Counter-Reformation. They started universities. They started in a very tardy way. They responded to the Reformation. They started printing. They did a worldwide missionary service. They started the Jesuits. The Jesuits were the soldiers of Christ or whatever. And because of that, the word propaganda took on very negative connotations in the Protestant world, the Northern European world, and so on. If someone would have been called a propagandist, let's say in the 18th century, 19th century, it would have been assumed you were talking about a Jesuit. Okay. With the Great War, World War I, and that era, propaganda emerges again. It became sort of synonymous with Germany, Austro-Hungarian Empire, and so on. And again, and these bad connotations continue. It became pretty evident about 1920s or so in America. See, America has this isolationist tradition, and it became very evident that America had been led into that First World War essentially by very skillful British propagandists who sort of co-opted the American media systems, learned how to utilize it. And America had been led by the nose. In a sense, the informational well that's supposed to inform rational democracy had been poisoned. And there was an interest in studying propaganda that emerged. Very early writers, a fellow named Harold Laswell, University of Chicago, writes a dissertation on propaganda technique in the World War. And he looks at the British, the Germans, the American efforts. And the Germans are klutzes. I mean, they use logical arguments.
exactly. I get that, yeah.
Oh, my, it's terrible. Here, I'll give you an example. There was a British nurse, very famous. A lot of monuments to her still up in Canada. I've seen them up there. I think her name was Edith Clavell. I may be wrong on that. But she was in a field hospital that was overrun by the Germans, so they continued treating prisoners. And the Germans were, you know, pretty civilized about it. They said, you can keep treating them, but they are prisoners of war. You have to treat them accordingly. And what Edith Clavell did was, once these prisoners, these patients became well, she helped them escape out of the German lines. Now, this is aiding and abetting the enemy, so the Germans tried her for this crime and shot her. Simple as that. This created world outrage. I mean, hence the Edith Clavell monuments in Canada. How dare these brute Huns, you know, do this to the flower of British womanhood and so on. Now, the same thing happened to a bunch of German nurses when the French overran their lines. And the Germans had no idea how to exploit this situation. Their response to these German nurses being shot was, well, it was the rules of war. They had to be shot. They had no idea how to exploit this.
Wow.
So anyway, so but the techniques that came out of the First World War in America, the war, the British very cleverly sold the war. They had atrocity stories. They sent British nobility to influence the decision-making classes in America. They were very clever about this kind of stuff. Americans started what was called Committee on Public Information. And public information, by the way, has become a synonym for propaganda or propagandists. And the people who worked for the Committee on Public Information after the war was over simply started using their, calling themselves public relations people, and started using their skills for commercial uses right after the war. And America has never been the same.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You mentioned Edith Clavell there, and it's like one of those good examples when we can look at things that occur today. I see so many things that are solely on an emotional level as opposed to, let's say, rational or logical. That it could be pertaining to when a story is being told by the media, for example. I think certain people have an approach that they want to go through the, you know, the who, what, how, when, very, you know, an overview. But many of the stories we get to us today are very emotional. They tell you nothing about the circumstances or what's going on or what happened prior. They're just trying to kind of wheel you in on the emotion. Is that a part of the propaganda technique?
Often. Some people who define propaganda or attempt to define propaganda say it's a use of emotional arguments and so on as opposed to rational ones. But I will tell you flat out that rational arguments in propaganda work pretty damned well. You can give someone 1,000 facts. You don't inform them. You drown them. You know, science, logic, all this stuff has its place. But people like stories. And a good emotional story with a happy ending or a morality play, these are very popular things. They're easy to absorb. There are certain cognitive advantages to the propagandist. I mean, they're already, people are very ready to receive these kind of stories. So, yes, they do play. As you know, we talked before the show, I do research on gun area and gun culture, American gun culture.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that has worked against gun culture is that the anti-gun people can tell all sorts of lurid tales, children injured with guns, innocent people, and so forth. And they tell these great stories, and they're reinforced in media representations. And they generally are just stories. I mean, that's all they are. But they're still emotional, and they penetrate.
Yep, exactly. Now, obviously, you talked a little bit about the three waves. You write about that in the beginning of the book of how propaganda kind of came onto the scene, and it's kind of a major jump time-wise from of course Catholicism to the First and the Second World War. Is there anything in between there when it gets kind of refined, or are there a lot of people, as far as you know, that work on this science and kind of advances it forward so that when it arrives in the First World War, the British and eventually the Americans, they have this as a powerful tool at their disposal? Is that what happened?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of the people who did propaganda in the First World War were journalists and so on. People like the writer Kipling, I think his name is. I'm thinking of the right guy. The guy who wrote that famous poem where it says, "A woman is only a woman, but a good cigar is a smoke." I'm trying to think of this. One of these British writers.
Yeah, I think it is Kipling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyways. You know, a lot of these guys were writers, and they're professional writers. They knew how to tell a story. And a lot of the people who did this were sort of worked in theatrics and so on. I mean, they drummed up business for vaudeville shows and things like that. They knew how the media system worked. They knew how to use media. They recognized in the budding mass media systems of those times that these systems needed content. And if you provided timely, exciting content to these mass media organizations, the tendency was that they would use it. So you find a lot of this happening at first. It was more like raw technique. There's a little psychology involved other than fear stories and a lot of stuff that I've seen from that era and read from that era, we would regard as very amateurish, very kind of jerking at your emotional strings and so on. Where it really starts becoming, propaganda really starts becoming a science is as World War II approaches. Essentially, I'm not being crude in saying this, but I think I'm right. a lot of the people who were busy analyzing propaganda and how it worked really got hired by the government to do it.
Exactly, yeah.
And they got hired, their research was subsidized. So you have this whole era of social research that gets either co-opted or was done right out, flat out, for the purposes of improving propaganda. And I'll give you some examples. Survey research. The reason survey research is developed and popularized is so you can test audiences for their sensitivities for propaganda messages and so on, so you can develop better propaganda, and also so you can gauge, measure the effects of propaganda. You need to do this so you can do this scientifically. A lot of social psychology research is done, you know, and group dynamics and so on is done. So, you know, okay, in the 1940 era, it is discovered that if you really want to change human behavior, as opposed to attitude. Now, attitude is relatively easy. It's like education. You put some information in, test it later, see if it's the information is still there or increased. But behavior is the hard thing. If you want to change behavior, you put people in groups. And all sorts of techniques were discovered for doing this. They became standard parts of the propaganda technique and so on. Even now in America, they have a program called DARE. It's an anti-drug program for children that most young people I talk to have been through it. And they have some of this group propaganda stuff where they put them in little role-playing scenarios, and these child is expected to resist a solicitation from a drug dealer and so on. So they use this kind of stuff constantly. And so science, social science improved propaganda technique considerably.
Now, they obviously, you said it was kind of very basic in the beginning, and again, I don't know how much you've looked into psychology here, and perhaps it's kind of a somewhat of a redundant question trying to figure out and or argue with human nature here and now, but why do you think that it works on us? Why don't we see through this?
Oh, there are lots of reasons why it works. One of my interests that accompanies my propaganda interest is my interest in religion. And we believe in religion for many of the same reasons why we believe and need propaganda. We need explanations. We need explanations of a higher order, that our life has meaning, that we're not all by ourselves alone, and so on. Religion does this for us, but so does propaganda. Propaganda makes you feel like you're some kind of great citizen in this world, and your decision to vote is going to matter in the long run, and you know, in sustaining your country and so on. And you're really part of this, and the little guy matters. If you look at the movies, are you familiar with Frank Capra?
Yeah.
Okay, Frank Capra was a genius. There's no doubt about it. He was. He also made propaganda films, besides things like you know, popular entertainment films. He understood the popular psyche. Things like It's a Wonderful Life.
Yep.
Well, he would basically take It's a Wonderful Life, which shows that the little guy has meaning and great meaning and so on. God cares. Everyone cares. You matter in the community. Well, he applies the same lesson to making anti-Japanese propaganda films, showing that the problem is, essentially he turns the value inside out, and he says the problem with those Japanese, those leaders of that Japanese, is they don't care about the little guy. And so these kind of, these are big human needs. And also people need, just going on this need line, people need to feel important, self-important. Propaganda gives you an explanation for the world. And I'll give you a quote here from Jacques Ellul. He's a French propaganda scholar. He calls himself, well, he's dead now, but he called himself a Christian anarchist. So that's an interesting label. And, I think about that sometimes. But he said, everything is explained thanks to propaganda. And I work in a university, and I've been around Detroit and so on, and I've worked in political jobs and things like that. And I've met a lot of ideologues of different sorts. I've met Marxists and fascists and Democrats and Christians and all sorts of people. And the thing they share in common is they all understand the world.
Of course they do. Yeah. And they knew it better than anyone else, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I get up in the morning sometimes, and I think I'm typical of people. I look around and say, what does all this mean? They don't do that. I think they know what it means. And, of course, they get an explanation that is really a propaganda. I mean, it benefits the propagandists and so on, the organizations that weave these kind of webs.
Control of the flow of information. Let's kind of dive into some of the commandments you have listed here and talk a little bit more about them. I think one of the, if we go back to the First World War again, one of the first acts that the British did was to cut the telegraph cable that connected Germany with North America, of course making it much harder for German propaganda to reach the United States, and it was a big task of the British to get the United States involved, just as it was in the Second World War. But this is a key moment, if you will, in how things unfolded. If you can control the flow of information, you have a pretty good start, right?
Maybe a pretty good finish, too. control the flow of information. I put that as the first commandment because I believe it to be the most important. As you noted, the British cut the transatlantic cable. And this is actually, the results of this have actually been measured by some early sociological type studies. Before about August 1914, had you read the New York Times or about 50% roughly of the war news would have come, or, you know, the news on the hostilities or outbreak or whatever in Europe would have come from Germany, the other 50% from France. After that, it goes 95 France, 5 Germany, for the simple, obvious reason that the transatlantic cable has been cut. This is, historically, the reason many societies licensed printing presses and so on, for example, is to control the flow of information. It's the reason for censorship. But you also control the flow of information by becoming a source for information. And this is in many ways the modern way in Western culture. You position yourself as a propagandizing organization in some place like the Beltway in Washington, and you open up a nonprofit organization or a think tank or whatever you want to be, and you create and produce information. Let me use the gun culture example again because I know this stuff very well. In the Beltway area, there are several anti-gun organizations. That's essentially what they are, is news services. They produce reports aimed at media people. They produce quotable quotes on demand. You can call them between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can get a good, usable quote on your topic if you're a journalist when you're working on a deadline. So you become a source, or you produce books. There's all sorts of ways this is done. So controlling that flow is probably the most important thing. And if you do it long enough, hard enough, you've certainly read 1984 by Orwell.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, the idea there is you just simply, your information is the only information that matters. I mean, that's an example of pretty much total control. But, you know, so some societies like North Korea, this is not a problem to them.
Well, I mean, is it not to us in the West now too? Just let's look at America specifically. I mean, we have about 6 corporations controlling about 90% of the media. You have GE, News Corporation, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. I think it's about 232 media executives that control the information flow to about 277 million Americans. That's control, right?
Oh, it certainly is. And, you know, this kind of concentration is unhealthy in my thinking. I'm a born pluralist. I mean, I love when people contribute and have something to say and create something and make something and send it out there.
I agree.
And this is not pluralism.
Well, thank God for the internet, but still, it doesn't. We don't stand a chance yet against the big media conglomerates out there. You know.
It's very difficult. And don't forget there, there's a lot of propaganda conveyed in this kind of entertainment media as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, you know, values and so forth. Sometimes I don't watch television because I feel I'm being preached to.
Didactic, right? It's always.
Oh, yeah, very much. And very heavy-handed, much of it.
Yeah.
If you put information out, you expect, the expectation is, at least in America, that you live in this rational democracy. And that you have a public forum for a marketplace of ideas. And, this is a very nice concept, and it probably applies when you're speaking among equals. But when you have this kind of concentration of resources and ownership and almost cultural barriers between, elite culture versus other cultures and so on, it makes an unhealthy situation. Now, in America, again, I've studied gun culture quite a bit. And the only reason gun culture is actually winning in a large sense in America. I mean, over the past years, they've taken over the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms and so on, which elite cultures had simply explained away as, that doesn't mean what it says. And the gun culture people have taken this over, resuscitated it. Gun rights have been invigorated and so on. People have concealed carry permits. There are 10, 15, 20 million of these people around the country now. and so forth. And the reason gun culture has been able to do that in the last 20 years is because of the internet, because they set up their own what I call horizontal media of communication, where they don't have to be excluded. They can control their own flow of information. And instead of being censored or laughed out of existence, they can talk amongst themselves, and it's very, very successful.
Do you think that that's one of the reasons why we're seeing it? And I would say this is true in many other countries. In fact, America is still a fairly decent place when it comes to your First Amendment, the free speech issue and all this. But in other parts in the West, we're seeing a heavily censored media. We're seeing, for example, it takes the shapes in different things. For example, political correctness, or that people are easily offended, which is have now become a mechanism to start censoring different opinions, right?
Oh, certainly. You know, when I teach in the classroom, I find myself censoring myself sometimes because out of fear that some student who probably doesn't understand half of what I'm saying anyways is going to go off somewhere and complain about it and say, he said this, this, and that. And then you're going to get some dean who doesn't really care and just wants to look good, politically correct. So you're going to have some trouble coming out of that. And sometimes, you know, they would seem like very innocent statements, but if you go against the flow, you can be in trouble.
Yeah, how is the university environment today, you would say? We've done many shows and talked about how not only cultural Marxism, but political correctness have kind of snuck into the university environment, and it's a very rigid, controlled environment today.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of this kind of hypocrisy. There's a lot of I think informing going on, and people run off and you know, you can be it's like the anonymous informant and said to us that you did this, and you can't even confront your accusers. Overall, I've had kind of an uphill struggle even since I did my PhD at Michigan. Just by working on gun culture, I annoyed to a great deal. Well, that my topic was verboten. I mean, simple as that. There was no way that they don't do research like that. And so I do this dissertation that, you know, it's a quantitative dissertation. It shows that NRA benefits by negative media coverage. But to show that, I had to show a lot of things. I had to, like, look at, like, 10 years of coverage and so on. And it was just unwelcome for the most part. I mean, I was accepted, and I managed to find accepted to a degree. I managed to find a dissertation committee that would work with this. But I was actually messed with, in a sense, at one time I was one of the senior faculty people tried to interfere with a dissertation writing fellowship that I was in line to get because they didn't like my topic, essentially. I called them on this, and I eventually got the fellowship. But this fellow was telling me things like, I don't even let my children play with toy guns. Like, this has something to do with my subject. I'm looking at media coverage and social mobilization, but he found this was an outrageous, even to look at this was a forbidden subject. So, and I see it when I send out articles for review. I've seen it around here. I've got when I went up for promotion to full professor, and I am a full professor, and I am a full professor because I publish a lot. And but I had one dean who tried to block my way, claiming she thought I was an advocate for gun culture or something.
Right.
And this is a woman in gender study person who certainly is an advocate for that. So I've run into a lot of this kind of stuff. And I think the only reason I'm tolerated is because I have published them. I have something like 5 books now. My 10 Commandments of Propaganda that we're talking about just came out in Polish. I've got a couple more books due to various people, publishers. And I write a lot. I mean, I have a lot to say. I have an agenda of research, and I'm going to work on it. But I do it despite them. I certainly benefit by my position as a professor to be able to do this kind of work. But I have no institutional support as far as doing research.
All right, folks, we just switched over to phone here. We had a little bit of trouble with Skype, but we'll carry on here, Brian. Then I want to ask you, one of the things within the university environment is we kind of have, you know, the 68ers, they pride themselves on inclusiveness, being open, diverse, or even rebellious and going against the grain. But I think what we've seen happened is that we've gotten a very controlled system where we have immense double standards and one-way tolerance everywhere. And this is going against, in some cases, what they, in the first place, advocated, doesn't it?
Oh, I believe so, yes. you know, this is not a line that's original for me, but I heard somebody defining diversity under one of the White House administrations in America, and said, well, diversity is a black liberal Democrat and an Hispanic liberal Democrat and an Indian liberal Democrat and a female liberal Democrat. And so there's an ideologically kind of unity. But there's it also becomes exclusionary. I recently, as I mentioned, I'm a senior professor now, and I'm ambitious. I mean, I like what I do. I like to teach. And, I may be ready for a mid-career shift and so on. Plus, I like to elk hunt, so I'd like to go somewhere where it's warmer, and they have mountains. So I've been looking at universities. But anyway, I applied for a job at a university I'm not going to name. And great, okay. So they announced recently that they had hired, they with great fanfare, they hired two professors for this job that they had advertised for. And they hired two, apparently a gay couple. Now, this wasn't in the ad. I mean, they weren't seeking, it doesn't say, like, looking for a gay couple or anything like this. And I'm okay hiring a gay couple because people, you know, if they're qualified and stuff like that. But I got the feeling this was just done because it was a gay couple, if you know what I mean. It was like a parroting or this trumpeting of kind of a diversity value.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, look what we did. And it was this, you know, and just because you did that, it itself is not a great triumph. I mean, it's okay. But it's not the, if you're hiring for substance and ability, that's beside the point.
Well, it's not meritocracy anymore. They do it on basis of identity or skin color, very shallow issues actually in most cases, which is kind of bizarre.
Yeah, and you know, if you think if you're going to be talking about academia and stuff, you should at least think about content a little bit.
You'd think, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know, but I do wonder, and I hear a lot of time and energy and money is wasted around here on issues like that instead of getting the best you can get and doing the best you can do. I mean, that's my take.
Well, I mean, isn't that one of the reasons why many people in America have been critical of, for example, affirmative action, because it does actually exclude based on skin color, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I have mixed feelings. I mean, I'm from Detroit, which was predominantly a black city at that time, and Detroit has a lot of problems, probably because it's a black city. I mean, this is how America is. There are a lot of giant metropolitan areas and so on that are essentially black cities, and they have all sorts of problems. I mean, it's a sad reality. And I was kind of invited to leave high school in Detroit in like my third year or something like that, because actually I've been reading all this propaganda stuff and I was like trying some of these crowd control things and it was not appreciated. That stuff works though, you know. So I wound up taking what's called a GED to graduate from high school, a general equivalency development test, the test. So I took it and it was assumed that I was a black kid from Detroit by the State Department of Education. And I got a call after I'd taken the test, and they said, would you like a University of Michigan scholarship? You did really well on this test. And I said, yeah, I'd like a University of Michigan scholarship. Because, you know, I come from working class and so on. That's quite an incredible achievement. So I went up to the office, that they gave me a number of an office, and they looked at me, and they discovered I was white. And that was the last I ever heard of that. They looked at me, and they said, we have to give you some more tests.
Oh man,
yeah.
It's ridiculous. I think it, just a related story, but I think it was the brother of there's some a celebrity out there. I forget her name. She's doing a show right now called Mindy. But anyway, her brother recently did. He was critical of affirmative action because he's Indian. His name is Vijay Chokalingam, and what he did is he rebranded himself as being an African American as opposed to an Indian American. And apparently he got into medical school due to this and all kinds of things, although his scores were fairly low and what have you. And anyway, there's a whole story right now that was released about this going around. But hopefully at least it will bring some attention to the very idea that either we have people in places because they're good at what they do, or that is just a facade and it just falls apart and we just do everything based on what identity or what they identify themselves as, right?
And again, you know, I try to be... I think a lot of problems in education and stuff like this are due to class. And, you know, working class people don't have a clue. I mean, because everybody they know, they don't know anybody who knows anything. Let's put it that way. I mean, they don't know how the ingress and egress points are of institutions and things like that. And so they need some help. And I could see helping people get into these things a little bit and having programs and mentoring and all sorts of things like this. But I can't see making sole decisions just based on the fact of some identity issue. I mean, it just doesn't make much sense to me. You know, but whatever. And it seems, even around this university and many others, there's a situation that I refer to as the subprime educational market. They want so-called minority students, and they solicit them. They go out and find them in the cities and so on, and they bring them in, the inner-city high schools, things like that. Okay, this is great, bringing people. Personally, if I wanted to find people who were deserving, I would go to the States and find out people who had taken GEDs and scored highly because they actually can pass a test. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But nevertheless, so at this university and many others, they bring them in, they give the kids what they call financial aid, which is maybe a little bit of a scholarship and a lot of financial aid in the form of student loans, guaranteed student loans. Then they have retention programs where you try to keep these kids around for 3 years, even though they might have like a 1.2 GPA out of a possible four. And then at the end of 3 or 4 years, 5 years I think is the metric they use, they have something like a 5% or a 10% graduation rate. So 90 to 95% of these people are flunking out. But they leave with $50,000 or $60,000 or more in loans that they will never discharge and that are essentially public. They're guaranteed by the public, the federal government. So this money goes directly into the university administrators and coffers and so on. The students really never touch it. And this is a way that some of these universities, and many universities, I believe, are skimming the system, supporting their administrative elites and so on, and not really delivering the services you would hope them to deliver. I suspect this is going to be one of those bubbles, like the real estate bubble, that's going to kind of pop one of these days.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of talk about that, and it's a huge industry now with the student loans and everything else like that. But let's get back to propaganda here a little bit and talk a little bit more about...
You know, but this is an educational propaganda, you know, opportunity for all.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you bet. Now, obviously, propaganda is a tool like everything else. I think usually these days it does conjure up a very negative image. We think about from marketing to subversion and manipulation, and these are, of course, many of the negative traits, but... It's basically a tool that can be used for mm-hmm. good or bad. Would you agree with that?
Sure. In fact, there are people who write on this who say basically there's good propaganda, there's bad propaganda. There are others who regard it as intrinsically evil just because it's deceptive. But yes, a lot of the American propagandists, the guy who begins the field of public relations named Bed Bernays, he was one of these Committee on Public Information people from the World War, First World War. And he essentially teaches the first class in public relations at NYU. He writes some books. He popularizes the term public relations and so on. But he regarded propaganda and public relations, which he did not discriminate between them, he regarded propaganda as a tool that made America great.
Right.
Because it created new markets, created new services, it expanded the West, you know, the Western expansion, all that was a lot of propaganda and so on. They told these settlers they were going out there and to find gold nuggets laying on the ground, so forth. I mean,
right.
Yeah, that was a big marketing campaign.
Yeah, I want to definitely talk a little bit more about Edward Bernays a little bit later here, but your third commandment, you talk about disambiguity, and I guess that kind of speaks to what we're talking about here a little bit. Sure, it can be used for good or bad, but the dichotomy is a part of it as well, of constantly also painting your enemy as a you know, subhuman or a very, you know, bad that you mm-hmm. need to be dealt with, etc. Tell us a bit more about that.
Okay. Third commandment, disambiguate. I'm going to give you a paraphrase from the psychologist Carl Jung. He said something like, the world is cold, gray, flat, and unending. And we just need some kind of myth or so on to make it more exciting. He claimed if you cut off all the mythology and the stories in the world today, by tomorrow they'd start growing again because we need them so badly. And propaganda feeds this need. There's no doubt about it. It makes your life exciting. Let's say you become a Marxist. Okay. And one stroke with the adaption of this adaptation of this ideology, you can go from merely being an unemployed bum to being a warrior in the class struggle. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, suddenly you take on meaning in life. Everything has contrast now. The same thing is true with union mobilization. The same thing is true with religious conversions. The same thing is true if you're going to be a progressive Democrat. If you wanted to become a Nazi at one time, you suddenly became a part of the Aryan race, you know, struggling to carry civilization forward and so on. I mean, the whole propaganda very clearly turns things into black and white dichotomies. And it needs to, because otherwise, you know, to explain things to the masses, they don't want a sociology lecture. They want a quick summary of your ABCD. And an ABCD is actually too complicated. I think they want A, B.
It seems to be something that's kind of part of us in that way. But at the same time, I do understand the fact that when groups and organizations mobilize, and this is kind of what we've seen in history, really. It's been a long path towards centralization, from the tribes in Europe that were consumed by the Roman Empire to when the Roman Empire started fighting with other empires. And it's like it's a big centralization, and you're kind of forced to make allegiances with people who you are kind of on the same page as, due to your very survival, perhaps. And when the when the opposition views you as your mortal enemy, then if you don't defend yourself against that, you're going to be an easy target, right?
Yeah. Two comments. One of the only remedies to propaganda, it's been said, is another propaganda.
Right.
And this notion of centralization this is just simply the direction of the modern world. I mean, it's the powerful trend. And as you say, to make people, to align them, to get them to behaviorally conform and so on, you've got to give them some overweening explanation of why they're doing this, where they're going, how they're doing it, why we're all marching in this direction. And propaganda is probably indispensable for this. I don't know how else you would convey this kind of idea.
Right.
Again, even looking at my colleagues and so on, who I tend to be sort of progressive, liberal Democrats and so on, they find meaning for all their personal actions in this ideology. I mean, what we're doing is working on this, and even though we're very wasteful and inefficient and so on, even if we only save one person, it'll be worth it. So that was your $100 million program, save one person. Yeah, right. that helps them line up and march. It's an important feature, and again, it speaks to a lot of the same needs as does religion and so on. I mean, you have a sense of belonging, you have a sense of opposition, and because maybe some people can do this, but living a meaningless life is, I don't think you live long. I don't think it can be done. Too much anxiety and so on.
We need that purpose, yeah. Well, perhaps it is human nature to a certain extent, and I think we are living maybe in a place today where we think we are over these things, or even that the need for propaganda itself is not something that's part of our society. We're living in open democratic societies now, and that's all to the past, but nothing could be further from the truth, right?
No, I think we are more propagandized than ever. In fact, I think people don't know the difference between that, and I don't think they have any personal realities. I think mainly in their head is just the residue of a bunch of propaganda campaigns, ideas and notions that kind of drift around. It's a sad thing to say, but, I wind up talking to a lot of young people, and I find a percentage of them are, they think and they wonder and so on, but a lot of them have no questions, which amazes me.
Wow.
How can you be 20 years old and have no questions?
Wow.
And they think they know. It's all been explained for them.
That's scary. That's actually very scary. I wonder sometimes where this will go, because I think I see around me this kind of an artificial bubble that most people are living in today, and it's very much managed by, as you said before, entertainment media, but obviously also the news media, because one of the problems here is that the opposition sometimes that we are offered are flat out just inventions and boogeymen, and they learn to utilize these as military techniques. I think it's been particularly pernicious after the Second World War, to be honest. The war to end all wars, or the good war, as they call it, which is a horrible way of looking at it, but
Well, that was a First World War, but they use the same lines in every war.
They do. Yeah.
Oh, you know, one thing I do point out in the book is that if you're into this sustainability notion or recycling and, you know, the environment, well, propaganda is the most recycled stuff in the world. I mean, everything in propaganda gets recycled.
Yeah, yeah. Because it works, yeah. Right? Knowing.
Yeah. Just change the flavor a little bit, put some orange dye on it, and send it back out.
Exactly.
I used to know a butcher who get spoiled meat, and he would treat it with all sorts of peppers and red dye and send it out as red hot sausages. He never had any spoiled meat.
There you go.
Kind of like propaganda.
There you go, exactly. Yeah. Now, let's move forward here. We're going to, in a few minutes here, we're going to take a break between the segments here, but we're going to talk a little bit more about your website and, of course, where people can get a hold of the book and whatnot. But tell us about the fourth one. Use group. You kind of talked about this a little bit before, but using group pressure to horizontally shape beliefs and behavior.
Okay. Yeah, I call this, actually, I don't call it this. Jacques Ellul, the French propaganda theorist, called it horizontal propaganda, and I like his term. Because when most people think of propaganda, they think of what would be vertical propaganda. It comes from some top-down source, like the White House or something, and it gets disseminated. A horizontal propaganda is made in groups and disseminated amongst groups. So if you want, I'll give you a classic example. Back in the Second World War, the problem faced in the U.S. was trying to get food rationing. I mean, you know, the entire economy was essentially co-opted and managed by the government. And the idea was that they wanted good meat cuts to go to the soldiers and so on. Millions of, you know, men were mobilized and so on. And they wanted the civilian market, which consisted of housewives shopping, to buy organ meats. Now, organ meats, I don't know what things are like in Europe, but here organ meats are not desirable. People don't even like to eat liver and so on, let alone hearts and kidneys and things like that. So this was a hard sell. And they could do top-down vertical information propaganda campaigns. And people, housewives, would learn from them. They knew that they were nutritious, the organ meats, and they were cheap, and the men at the front needed the meat and all that. But they still wouldn't buy them. This guy named Kurt Lewin, he's remembered for a psychological school called Group Dynamics, gets the brilliant idea to take these housewives in the target audience and put them on committees and charge them with the task of getting women to buy organ meats.
Hmm.
Now, this is funny. In a way, it's ironic. So when you put people to work on these committees, and some kind of dynamic develops where they have to, their behavior has to become more consistent with their attitudes. They can't be seen. They've made a sort of a public within the group offering of themselves, a kind of a commitment and so on. And it's embarrassing to them. They say, you know, at some level they say, well, I did this, so I must be like this, and the behavior starts to change. And this is a principle that's used in smoking, anti-smoking groups, Alcoholics Anonymous, drug support, group therapy. Now it's used in corporate management and so on. You know, they have team management in all these corporations and what they call employee management and participation, so-called democratization of the workplace. But actually these things, really what happens is when you get these group work situations, instead of having one supervisor, like under the old vertical systems, now you have 12. Everybody watches everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And you watch them up, and you're watching them back. So it's really a more efficient way to control people, and it's more extensive. Plus, it doesn't have the negatives of the old system where you'd have like a job description and you know, like a vertical kind of bureaucracy where everybody does this and component. Here's your job. You do A, B, and C. Well, now your job gets defined as you go around. So it's like this open-ended contract with all these expectations. And you report to your peers so you can't really disappoint, and so on. So it's a very, very strong method. Also, I notice even in matters like U.S. politics, like in gun culture, the reason gun culture has been able to prevail as it has, even though it's been faced by an astonishing amount of elite professional opposition, is that gun culture actually has an organic, valid, functioning horizontal component. Gun culture is organized into these little groups all over the place, and they're all in interior communication with themselves and each other. And they're behaviorally strong. They vote. They act in concert. They coordinate their activities from all over the coasts and so on. And it works. And these people that are organized in, they're not even organized, the vertical propaganda people, they have some little attitude that's like ephemeral. And they'll watch a little bit of TV and they'll say, oh, those guns, they're just terrible. And they kill children and stuff like that. But then about a week later, they forget about it and they're thinking about somebody killing baby seals or something. And they've moved on to something else. Meanwhile, the gun people are still in their groups doing what they do. So I think that's a pretty good explanation of how horizontal propaganda works and horizontal mobilization.
So in other words, if we are in a place now where we see the current rulership, the globalism, the kind of the bureaucracy of you know, the countries that are working together, or, you know, the federal government in the States or the European Union, what have you, as kind of big, immovable, organizations that are working against us, then we could adopt some of the rules of propaganda to be able to try to begin to chip away at some of these massive organizations.
I would think so. Yeah. And again, just organizing into informational, what I call horizontal interpretive communities. You know, this is essentially, the United States is really organized in these horizontal interpretive communities, as I call them, these groups, among religious models. This is a Reformation kind of thing. At one time, and maybe the Europeans, and this is my perspective as a stupid American. I mean, I'm on the other side of the ocean, and I kind of look back and I say, what is going on over there? I think one of the advantages of the U.S. is they had all these religious sectarians that came, had to come over to the New World, because they couldn't get along with anybody else, and they set up their own little societies, and then they kind of developed this uneasy pluralism between themselves. And a political system where you had these all these little groups and so on, and somehow or other you had to come up with a republic and all that, and eventually this all develops. But there's an informational pluralism, and then there's groups and these voluntary associations and so on that are very powerful. Now, I don't know that Europe has these voluntary associations as to the extent America does. And again, I might be speaking flat out ignorance here, but this is just my impression. America has, to my knowledge, there's actually an encyclopedia that lists these things, about 60,000 voluntary associations that are large enough to merit an entry in the Encyclopedia of Associations.
Hmm.
And some of these groups range from the National Rifle Association, 5 million members, the NAACP, down to these little groups like, you know, who study like helicopter aeronautics and stuff like that, very specialized groups and technical trade groups and so on. And the system is really set up, even the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is really an amendment so these people can talk. It was never intended to, even though it covers journalists nowadays, and journalists love this because they think it's for them. Well, back in the 1790s when this was drawn up, there were no journalists. So, you know, what they're talking about is these groups so they can publish their own stuff, so they can assemble, so they can meet, so they can petition the government. Now, I'm not sure if Europe is Europe, in my impression, again, I'm a stupid American, is more monolithic than that. I mean, there are older power structures, and I think there's more of an understanding of class in Europe. I get that impression. Like, you know, like when you talk about the middle classes in Europe, you're not talking about factory workers. You know what I mean? Or are you? Yeah, okay. I mean, the people know there are working classes, lower classes, and so on. And America, is, again, more fragmented like that, but these groups actually articulate policy and they affect government policy. And I think it's been going on here for a long time, and it was just sort of an assumed way of running things. And now I follow gun politics as they're moving to Europe a bit. And I know there are some European gun groups that have been forming, but they seem to have a lot of trouble because they don't seem to have the kind of playing field that the gun groups have in America. Even at the United Nations, I understand some of the gun groups, like one of the gun groups I'm familiar with, had to form, what do they call it, an NGO, a non-governmental organization, to be able to talk to the European. Yeah, and
that's
it's a
right.
different, it's a different informational sociology. And so, but I think Europe can do this. I don't see why not. But I think it just takes a little, you have to just look at things a little different or try to maybe some imagination of things that, hey, we can do this and we can do it our own way. That's
right.
My guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is easier said than done.
It sure is, exactly. A lot of this is very much established. You have to do it in a specific way and all that. So it takes a lot to alter the path that we're on. And as we said before, when you do control the media and when you control the flow of information, it becomes very difficult to pierce through that and start to change opinions. And if we don't like the path that we're on, it's going to take a lot of effort by a lot of people to try to turn things around, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, you almost have to set up your own informational systems. Because and you can do this online as long as it remains available and so on. But it's not easy. And, you know, the thing that amazes me in America, at least on the gun, again, I'm speaking of the gun issue because I see how it works clearly, and I know it well. The gun people were amateurs and still are, and yet they beat long-established professional networks with these little state-level associations and stuff. That's an interesting notion.
Yeah, I was going to say, look at like Samizdat in the former Soviet Union, for example. Very small outlets, but they were chipping away at the establishment. And okay, certainly they have organizational problems. It was kind of falling apart on its own almost. But nonetheless, I think those kinds of things aided in the process to detopple and make the Soviet Union fall. So I think there is encouragement in those kinds of examples.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing. Remember old Thomas Hobbes. Leviathan,
mm-hmm.
Things about basically political systems and so on, social contract, I would call it. He makes a comment about these voluntary associations, and he doesn't like them, because he thinks that the voluntary associations, these pluralistic groups, he calls them worms in the entrails of society, which is interesting, and because they're so potentially unsettling. But I also think that if you really want to have an opinion on something that will affect public opinion, you should become part of one of these publics. Some of the American sociologists at the old Chicago school used to call these little groups publics. And to really have an opinion, you had to be part of a public. It just wasn't, you'd ask some guy in, watching TV and call him on the phone and say, what do you think about this? And he goes like, huh? And that's not public opinion. Public opinion is when you join a group and have a conversation amongst yourself and articulate one. So, and those are powerful things. And, you know, again, I'm going to use NRA for an example because I know a lot about it, but there's 40 or 50 other gun groups in America, like Jews for the Preservation of Firearm Ownership, Pink Pistols, Gay Gun Rights Group, Women for the Second Amendment. There's 40 or 50 of them.
Right.
NRA is its own. They have a speakers bureau. They have a library. They do legal interventions, like legal eagle kind of strategies, specific lawsuits and so on. They do media relations. They do safety training. They certify coaches for shooting events and police work. I mean, they have manifold functions. And this is a non-governmental group that is probably bigger than many state governments. So these groups really have a lot of power where they can extend their way and they can influence a lot of people. NRA publishes maybe, 5 million members. They send a magazine to every member every month. I don't think that many people read the New York Times.
Yeah.
If you think about it, they talk to a lot of people. And I guess that, you know, kind of suggests how this can be done, although it's not easy.
Yeah, let's talk more about that later in the second, a little bit about some of the tactics, and also maybe why, despite a lot of the negative press, why people have been attracted to it. They say, of course, there's no such thing as bad publicity, and of course we can talk more about how that can be used as well. But before we take a break here, obviously, I want to mention some of the titles. I want to give out your website. You have a blog called Rise of Anti-Media. Tell us about the blog.
Yes. Oh, okay. Rise of the Anti-Media. I've told it an unfortunate name by a couple of critics, but I'm keeping it because I have it now. My idea is that these voluntary associations succeed because they create their own anti-media. That's how gun culture succeeded. You make your own media, the anti-media. And all I do on Rise of the Anti-Media, I do things like I do book reviews. Recently I reviewed a book, for example, called I think Negroes and the Gun or something. It was about the black tradition of arms in America. Very interesting book on a topic that's not very well treated anywhere that I know of. A guy named Nick Johnson writes it. He's a professor at Fordham Law. And I put things up there. I'm a shooter. I shoot competitively, and I come from a gun culture background. My father was a great hunter and so on. And I take pride in these things, and I try to do them well and intelligently. So I'll review guns, just as like I would review a book. And so I try to just keep things up there that may be of interest to people that, you know, are interested in what I'm interested in and so on. And people talk about it. And I put my books up there, of course, too.
Very good. Let me give out some of the titles. Obviously, the main book we're talking about here is called The Ten Commandments of Propaganda. But you also have Zombology, the National Rifle Association and the Media, a number of other titles as well. Where can people go to pick up copies of the books?
most of these books have been reprinted by Arctos. A couple were done by academic publishers. But Arctos has been very good about publishing these things, and I like Arctos. They're all available on Amazon or from Arctos media site. They're pretty easy to get. And they're fun books. I mean, I'm not bashful about writing what I think in a book, even though some of my academic friends are horrified.
Well, that's good. We need more people who are just don't give a damn about what everyone thinks all the time. Everyone is so easily offended these days, and it kind of bothers me, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to tell you something right now. I work in this academic environment now for 15 years, I think, and the only dean that ever liked me died. So
that's too bad.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I grievously offended all the other ones.
All right. Again, here at the website, before we take a short break, riceofantimedia.blogspot.com. We'll have this linked up, and also, of course, check out the publisher, arctos.com. We'll link to some of the books that we've been talking about here. But all right, stay with us, Brian. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back with more. Second hour, we continue to go through the other commandments of propaganda as Brian lists them in the book. It's an interesting discussion in the second here as we continue to go over how propaganda has been used and also how it might be able to be used for good. Propaganda is simply a tool, and if we can understand it, not only historically, but also how it's been applied today, we might not only be able to break down the hold it has over us, but we might actually be able to use it ourselves to change things in the direction we'd like to see. We get his take on future of civilization and also why we should go to battle and fight the evil that we see in the world. Well, if you want to hear more, we have a lot more to go through here in the second. We speak more about gun culture and zombology right at the end as well. Some interesting things are coming up. So join us at redicemembers.com. You can go there to hear more of this upcoming hour and all our previous programs, so you can dig into the massive archive we have for you, ladies and gentlemen. It's only €5 per month. We have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years, whatever works for you. Well, before we proceed here, upcoming on the program, we have Mike Walsh, Tom Goodrich and Kyle Hunt, Neil Kramer, Ulla Damegård, Christopher Hell, Veronica Clark, Kevin McDonald, and many more. Stay tuned, the second hour with Brian Anspatrick is next. Thank you for listening.